Welcome everyone to the second week of Stories Remembered About Swamiji, lessons that we've witnessed, seen, sometimes had firsthand. And last week was such a wonderful class. It really, I just left feeling just soaring, like we'd just been with Swamiji. He'd been in the room and we were all remembering and being in the heart with David as he shared what things had, he was sharing with us that week. And I know he has many more to come next week. And I started making some notes, and it's been a wonderful project because I'm remembering more and more stories as I drive down the freeway. Oh yeah, that reminds me of that one, and that reminds me of that one. So I hope this will do the same for all of you, and reminding you about spiritual lessons that you've gotten through Swamiji's hand. And that could mean, you know, when he was in the body walking around, pointing things out, things we got to see him do when he was in his body, but also he certainly, his consciousness that he channeled from Master, from God, from the truth, all is that exists for us in the books and the videos. In preparation, I was watching a couple of videos. There's one that popped up, his last one at the village, and it was about Patanjali. I just watched it this last week. And, you know, he said the same thing year after year from the very beginning to the very end. These are the yogic teachings. This is the best way to live. This is how you find happiness. So his message continues to grow within each one of us and out into the world as more and more people find out. But in our cozy little group, we're remembering stories. And as David mentioned last week, Swamiji would always, you know, when people would say, tell us stories about Master, tell us stories. And he'd say, I don't just, like, think about them. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, when somebody asks me that, I usually tune into the person and the situation and a story that might help them take their next step spiritually. So, you know, we'll sort of put the finger in the air and hope that the ones we choose will be helping someone out there think about things in a way that is useful. I'm just going to start in. It's funny. I don't know how many of you have ever been to a lecture of Osho or Swamiji's or any of our great teachers, and you sit in the lecture and you're so uplifted and you think, oh, that point makes so much sense, and oh, that answers that question, and yes, I'm really understanding the teachings more now. This is really great. And then someone, as soon as you get out of the class, someone says, what was it about? You know, and everyone kind of looks at each other and goes, it was about God. That was what, you know, it became the joke. It was about God and how to find God. But we would try and get away with things like that. Like around Swamiji, he would say, well, what did you think of that lecture? And I would say, in truth, really quite truthfully, Swamiji, it was beyond words, which is true. But he wouldn't let us get away with that. He's kind of, come on, try and at least put your mind and your experience a little bit together. You know, just give it a try. So we would. My time with Swamiji was mostly in silence. So most of this class will be in silence. No. It was mostly in silence, though. I came to Ananda Village. I had left the corporate world and all the things I tried, you know, the things we all try. And I decided this world is in big trouble and there are a lot of people suffering. And I think let's try and find a way to help them. So I had taken massage classes to try and be an energy healer, maybe be a chiropractor, I wasn't sure. But I knew people were suffering, and if I could, you know, somehow help them. So I had just finished my training when I came to Ananda Village, and hadn't really worked on very many people, except my mother when I was growing up. And Swamiji, at that time, you know, Swamiji laughed toward the end of his life being in the emergency room and the doctors passing around his chart and kind of exclaiming, you know, can you believe this? You know, this guy's been through all these different things. And when I was there from 1987 to 1995, many of those adventures in the body were happening. So because of my training and because I think he wanted to keep me out of trouble and give me something to do, he allowed me to work on him. I would give him head rubs and feet rubs, and then as his hips were bothering him, the doctor said massage was good, so I would also work on him that way. So I would show up. I would call. I'd say, Swamiji, how are you doing? You know, would you like a treatment? And he would basically say, well, I wouldn't object. So I'd go over thinking, you know, he really does. It seems a nice thing for him, and I'm happy to be able to give something to this man who's giving so much. So I would work on him. And this happened a lot. You know, it was just sort of part of the rhythm of the day. I'd work wherever I was working in the community and call him up, how are you doing? Would you like a treatment? I wouldn't object. I'd go over and rub his feet and then rub his head. And early on, one of the reasons it was mostly in silence, early on I thought, gosh, this is probably kind of boring for him. I mean, I just come over and I rub the same feet pretty much the same way, and I rub his head pretty much the same way. Maybe he's getting kind of bored. So I'm thinking, you know, after several days, I'm thinking, he must be getting kind of bored. Maybe he'd like me to talk or ask him questions or something. Maybe that would show more, you know, more interest or dynamism or better discipleship or something. So I tried, Swamiji, something, he said, you know, it's better when you're working on me if you just keep your attention at the point between the eyebrows. Mm-hmm. So I thought, good. So I never had to talk after that, pretty much. So it would just be, you know, time in silence. It was just sadhana. It was just being in his vibration. And as best as I could, look up at the light and, you know, as I'd learned in my training, to be an instrument and let that energy flow through. And I mostly was like a witness. And it was like Swamiji worked all day, counseled, wrote, planned, managed, did all the things he did in the day, meetings. And then he would have this little break of a time before his meditation. And it was like Divine Mother. I could kind of feel her just rubbing her hands together. Like, oh, goody, I really get to just let some of my energy flow to him, you know, right now, just to help him relax. So that was a lot of the role. I worked for Crystal Clarity, and I loved the teachings. So I had read everything before I came to the village, and the way I had learned about the spiritual life before coming to Ananda was by books. I read lots and lots and lots of books. I was psychology, philosophy, art, women's rights. You know, that was a big time of the age. How to love, psychology. I was interested in why and how, and I had read a lot of books. So then when I got into the spiritual interest, I read a lot of those books. And then when I got to Ananda, I read all the books. And then I came to the village. So I had my own meditations were through reading. That was my satsang, was I would read what Swamiji wrote, what Master wrote. And I was so on fire. And then early on, one of the things that strike a lot of us about Swamiji is his... has been his humility. And as Master said, there's, you know, where's their humility when, you know, when the ego is almost gone or gone? You know, it's not really a point for humility. But when I first came to Ananda, it was Spiritual Renewal Week, and it was in the Temple of the Trees outside, and many people were seated, and the word went through the crowd. I just came with a friend. I didn't really know much about their village. I just had read the book, so... So Swamiji, everybody said, he's talking today, he's talking. I'm thinking, wow, this is going to be amazing. You know, I was kind of expecting some version of a spiritual brass band to kind of come down the road and be like, here he comes. You know, I just felt like it was a celebration that everybody was really looking forward to. Well, I sat in my chair and I watched, and along came this little Chevy kind of jalopy, glumping down the road and up to just next to the dais, and quietly, you know, someone got out, walked over, started talking about Sanatana Dharma, the teachings, yoga, you know, in a very even-minded tone, very calmly, and it was not exciting at all. And I was a little surprised, coming from, you know, the world. But at that day, he took everyone through a guided Hong Sa practice. And just the truth humbly came through him in such a powerful way. Everyone was uplifted, and I kind of had my first Divine Mother lifting me, you know, by the back of my neck and putting me in a high consciousness so that I knew this was really important, this was really real. This was the happiest I'd ever been, the most joy I'd ever felt, and just in that little time of doing Hong Sa. So Swamiji taught humility. You know, he was always saying, I don't do this writing, this book, this music. It just, God's doing it, and I just ask him, what do you want me to do? And then I act from that inspiration. There was a story when I first came, I was working for, there was a special department that was formed to help celebrate the 40th anniversary. What would it have been in 1987? Anybody know? 40th?
Maybe
25th. 60th, 25th. No, 15.
No, 69 to be 84.
Maybe it was the 20th. 20th.
Oh, yeah, it's
15.
Like it.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, if it's
80s. Yeah. Anyway, it was an anniversary, a big anniversary. And so they had a little department to promote it. And Swami had just written the book, Cities of Light. And I was eagerly working. And I had just come from working in offices before I did massage. So I used to do executive assistant work. And I had, you know, executives don't always pay attention during grammar class. I think they're dreaming about the big businesses they're going to make or something. So, you know, a lot of them didn't have all the English, and they'd be really happy that I would help kind of correct their letters a little bit, you know, smooth it out here and there, make sure the punctuation was right, the capitalization. Sometimes they were moving too quickly to do that themselves. So a letter came out, and I did the same thing. I just thought, oh, here, I'll just, you know, help clean this up a little bit. Well, for whatever karmic thing was going on, the person I did it for was really upset, just thought this was a horrible thing for an assistant person to do. So went to Swami and just, you know, railed about it. So Swami called me, and he scolded me. And I didn't defend myself. I just took it. He said, you know, you should know, you know, if somebody wants you to help them in that way. You shouldn't just presume that. And then he looked at me, and it was a moment because I was new and I was really open by that correction already. And I looked at him like, I definitely want to be different. So I was very open. And he said, he looked at me with this calm kindness in his eyes. And he just said, seek to be the least, and God will give you your rightful place. And that's one of my favorite ones because I've used it in so many circumstances. Anytime I start feeling my ego getting just a little up, you know, like, well, what about, you know, shouldn't I be able to, or why did that happen? If I go back to that and remember that look in his eye, seek to be the least. I meditated on it a lot, and it's like, what does that mean, you know, seek to be the least? It's really just letting the ego dissolve, isn't it? It's just not thinking you're supposed to be ahead of or in front of or, you know, your own needs aren't as important as we tend to think they are. And so just seek to be, could use a lot of other words there, seek to be free, seek to be humble, seek to be content. You know, there are lots of things, but that seek to be the least has been a great mantra kind of for me. One of the days when I was working on him, you know, somebody used to call crystal clarity, which is where Swami did his books, Swami's karma mill, because it's a high energy, you know, trying to get these teachings into the hands of the world, trying to translate them. Swamiji, you know, offering himself up as that instrument, master trying to bring that high level of amazing energy into the world. And so, you know, it's a birthing process. So during that, you know, it's like an emergency room a lot of times it was, with things going on. And with that high energy, people's samskars would start bubbling up and come out. And it was a little bit like a karma mill. You know, things happened all the time with our own karmas. And there was a man who was going through, we could just see that he was struggling with something. We weren't sure what it was. You know, we weren't really, he wasn't sharing with us. It wasn't like a group kind of thing like that. But he could just see he was struggling. And one day he went off to visit with Swami. Swami had him up for tea. And he came back and he looked, you know, a little more radiant and a lot more relaxed. And he had this little piece of paper that he put, he had a picture of Swami on his desk, and this little piece of paper he put, "Freedom is the goal." And we asked him, he said, "That's what Swami said to me." So that became his little mantra for a long time. He was just trying to find his way through whatever delusion was around him. He just kept thinking, no, freedom is the goal. You know, this particular man was trying to be successful and, you know, doing the male thing of the ego of having to prove things, and, you know, we could see, you know, a little bit of what he was struggling with. But with that freedom, Swamiji just kind of allowed him to just look at something else. That's the goal. It's not all these other things I'm getting all tight about. So that was one of the fun ones. Swami was really good at encouraging people, but not just making it easy for them. You know, he would, I remember, because I earlier mentioned I loved the teaching, so I read them all, and I was so alive with them, I wanted to share them. That's natural. You know, gosh, this is the best thing I've ever found. People could benefit so much from these teachings. Let's find a way to share them. You know, let's share them. How can I share them? How can I kept looking around. How can I share them? How can I share them? So, of course, I tried with my family. Well, that didn't go as well as one might have hoped. So then I thought, what's next? You know, where can I do it? Where can I do it? And, you know, I just jumped into the community. The next thing that was up was Earth Song, because that was a job that had a paycheck, and I needed to pay my dues and everything and rent. And so I would drive into town and work at Earth Song, and it was a wonderful karma yoga opportunity. We ran around like crazy. Being a waitress is not as easy as it looks like, folks. I always tip really well. you know, juggling lots of things and plates and trays and orders and people.
Was it
and
a cafe?
It was a cafe. Okay. I was in the cafe part. And moms coming in with their hungry babies screaming, and, you know, just a lot of different energies that I wasn't really used to working with. So there I was doing it, and thinking, this is my sadhana, this is my spiritual challenge, I will rise to this. And I was doing pretty well, and I lasted pretty well with those, you know, those feelings. I'd go in the basement and meditate. But then I kind of started looking around, you know, and I thought, here I am. Well, let me just talk to this person about master. They'd come in, you know, give me my earth burger, and I go, have you heard about the autobiography?
No.
You know, I tried little ways. I don't think I was that obvious, but little ways. Like, have you read this book? You can't have your lunch until you read the first page. I go that far. But I was sort of feeling out, how can I share the teachings with these people? You know, and it wasn't working. Nobody really, you know, they were hungry. So Swamiji came in, and I don't think I had written him about it. I think I was just feeling like kind of discouraged, like I really, you know, early zealotry, I have a mission for God and I'm not doing it, you know, theme of my life. But I really wanted to share it, and he knew that. So he said, how are you doing? He came into one of the benefits of working at Earth Song, he said he would come through, and it was fun. He'd go to the doctor's or something, and he'd come in, and he'd have his carrot juice or his smoothie or something. One time, he was getting a smoothie, and he'd come, he'd be by himself, and we would get to say hi to him, and he'd take a moment, you know, and just say hi. But this day he was surrounded by other people. They were traveling together with him, and they were all talking, and no real chance to connect with him. So I thought, well, that's okay. I'm making his smoothie. I'm going to put all the love that I have, all the appreciation, all the gratitude, I'm going to put it into the smoothie while I'm making it. So I put it on, and I'm holding this thing, you know, really putting all my energy into it. And then I thought, okay, now at least I can give him this. So I just sat it right by his plate there, and he took one sip. He stopped, looked at me, he said, this is the best smoothie I have ever had. How did he know? He's just sensitive. So one of the other times he came in there, he looked at me, and he could see I was troubled. And he said, what's the matter? How are you doing here? He said, it's all right, Swamiji. It's all right, but you know, people that come here, they're not really interested in the teachings. He looked at me with this just a straight up kind of look. He said, no, they come here to eat lunch. Oh, yeah, I guess they do. And he said, too bad you couldn't work at Crystal Clarity. And that was it. I thought, why is it too bad? Why can't I work at Crystal Clarity?
Well, you hadn't.
No, I wasn't then. I was just in the cafe. That was the only place I'd work, except for a little while, but, you know, during the summer. I thought, well, it sounds like he might like me to. Like maybe that's a good idea. So I just kind of pulled on that cord, you know, for a long time, like the little in the labyrinth, you know, I just kept pulling on it. Time went by, things happened. I had a kind of bad back injury from carrying the trays in probably the not right way. And I was kind of laid out for a while. And during that time, I basically meditated a lot and got my courage. And I said, you know what? I am going to share these teachings. I'm going to find a way to do it. Swami mentioned Crystal Clarity. I'm just going to volunteer there. And if I can't pay my rent and they kick me out, that's the way. Now, this isn't necessarily something everybody should do all the time because it doesn't always work out. But I felt guided in that direction. And I went up and I went for seclusion. And during that time, I just meditated and meditated. And I reached a point of trying to gain the courage to trust God enough to do that without any savings and without any knowledge that it could work, but feeling in my heart that that's what I was trying to do. So I was doing my kriyas like anything, really intensely, in this little meditation kutir where I was up at the seclusion retreat. And coincidentally, I discovered I had planned my timing around a quiet time at the village and at Ursong. And I was there, and it also happened that it was a quiet time in Swamiji's schedule, so he landed up there. So I knew he was in his little dome over there, and I was in my little kutir, a little one-room place. And I was doing my kriya, and I felt like I was almost going to break through. It was like, darn it, if I can just do a little bit more, I can get rid of this, whatever this is in the way, this fear that I can't go forward about. And and then while I was facing up against it, it seemed to get bigger. And I got really scared because it was like fear was really gripping. So I tried to meditate, I said, what do I do now, God? Here I am, I'm in seclusion, I'm trying to take the next step to serve you, you know, and get closer, and what do I do? And so I heard this little voice in my head said, go see Swamiji. I said, no way, he's in seclusion and I'm in seclusion, that's ridiculous, I'm going to go walking up there, nothing, so I'm not going to do that. So I went back, and the voice, go see Swamiji. I said, well, that's twice, you know, maybe I could do it on my own. And kept trying. Third time, a little bit louder, you know, go see Swamiji. So I said, well, you know what? It's the best I can do. This is what I'm getting. So, who's that fellow who writes? I don't know who it is when I say this. It was a dark and stormy night. It really was a dark and stormy night. It was raining. It was dark. No lights up there. I had a flashlight. I started out. About halfway through, my flashlight gave out. So now I'm battling my inner darkness, and now there's this outer darkness. I'm in the woods. I was a city girl. I don't identify with that necessarily anymore as much. But I was totally a city girl as much, to be truthful. But I, you know, like, I did not have a compass. I did not have, there were no stars. And it was wet and cold, and it was literally a stone's throw from my little cabin to where Swamiji's dome was, but I couldn't see what direction to go in. Right. So I was, you know, doing my best and kind of going through, and then I finally saw a stairs, and I saw this little gentle light coming out. And I knew that it must be the cabin because it was the only one around. And so I, screwed up my courage. I went up the stairs, And then he had the curtain open just a little bit, and the light was coming out, so I kind of tiptoed up like this, and I knocked very, very lightly. And I heard this voice, "Come in." Oh, just like welcoming, calm. And it was like he was the eye of the storm. He was perfectly calm, sitting in his chair reading, with a little reading light behind him, had a little footstool there. He said, "What?" I don't remember exactly what he said, but just come in, and what can I do for you, maybe he said. And I said, "Swamiji, I'm really trying to do my kriyas, and I feel like I'm almost getting through something, but now I'm really scared, and I don't know what to do." And he said, "Well, how are you doing your kriyas? Sit here." So I sat on the little stool, and I showed him. "Oh," he said, "you're using, you know, you're doing it too intensely with your body, too physically," he said. So then he guided me in this beautiful gift. He said, "Now, why don't you breathe into your heart and visualize your heart as a lotus opening its petals. And then offer the energy from that lotus up to the point between the eyebrows. Then bring the energy back down into the center of the lotus." So he kind of walked me through that a few times, and then I said, "Thank you, Swamiji." Then I went to my little meditation seclusion cabin. And I did that, and darn if it wasn't an amazingly powerful technique. And I was thinking, he found one just for me. He made it up for me. You know, wow, this is so beautiful. Actually, what happened, we're not supposed to talk about our spiritual experiences, but I've only had about 5 of them, so if I give one of them, you know, it's been 40 years, you know, pretty not so much hot stuff. But what he blessed me with in that was, as I was doing it, you know, the lotus, you know, then suddenly, I don't know, I'd been to Dhananda maybe a year and a half. I hadn't heard anything about this. But suddenly there was this, at the point between my eyebrows, there was this pearl, like a silver, shiny pearl. And it was glowing, and it was like the moon, but it was different. And it was so engaging that I just, you know, went with that. And I thought, wow, that was an amazing present that Swamiji gave me. And then I learned later that people call that sometimes the pearl of great price. And I thought, I see why. You know, it's so comforting and luminous, and it just took away all my fear. And years went by with me thinking, oh gosh, that was so special. Swamiji gave me that pearl, and whatever that was, whatever it was, that experience. He found it, just thought it up. And then he was giving a lecture, and he said, "As it says in the Srimad Bhagavatam, if you meditate as a lotus and it goes up in the pearl of..." And it's like, Swamiji, you just took it out of a book, you know. But of course, the truth is what it is, and we want to have those personal things. There was one satsang, I think it was in Palo Alto, and Swamiji, somebody asked him a question. It was really a good question. He said, "Swamiji, why do the masters keep coming back time after time? Why do they do it?" There's a lot of ways you could answer that question. But Swamiji gave an answer I'd never heard and I always remember. He said, "The masters come back so that each one of us can have a personal experience of God's love for us." That's a lovely way of putting it. So they just make it real, you know, so that we can listen to their voice, you know, tune in, close our eyes, meditate on the picture, you know, so that we can, it just helps us have that devotion and know that we are loved that way. I would say my path before coming to Ananda was, I had a girlfriend who was working in Crystal Clarity at the time, and she'd had a little bit of a similar background, and the way she described it was just perfect. She was kind of a country and western kind of girl. She said, "Well, you know, I think my path so far has been like looking for love in all the wrong places." And I don't think all the places I've been looking were wrong, but I hadn't found the right one, and I'd been frustrated that I couldn't find you know, my mother's love was unconditional, but then she wasn't perfect, so there that was. I remember reading Eric Fromm's The Art of Loving and the different kinds of love that there are, brotherly love, platonic love, human love, passionate love, all the different kinds. And I just was confused. I just knew I wanted love that was perfect, but I didn't know. It didn't seem like any of them were getting there. Some were better than others. But so I just had this searching, you know, still going on. And so when I came to Swamiji, you know, love was reading the Divine Romance and, you know, trying to go into that vibration that is the perfect love. And and Swamiji said something to me once. I don't remember. I said something about what's love like in the astral world, or what is perfect love, or I asked him a question based on that long search that I'd been on. And he said, love, he said, is only found in perfect stillness. And that was wholly different than I've been thinking all my years of searching and trying to make it happen and find it and make it and do it and be it. A perfect stillness. I hadn't thought of that one. But it just gave me a direction, you know. Go into that a little bit more. Let me try perfect stillness. I'm just trying too hard on this thing. Just try and be still and see what that feels like. And one time, you know, we want to see, we want to objectify, personalize our love. As the feedback mechanism, I mean, there's something very sweet even about the soul and God, you know, the separation that you feel, I love you, God. God loves me, the soul, you know, even at that level, what to speak of the human love that we feel we need and want and work with and explore and grow through. Seeing Swamiji, being in his presence, and as I was a lot in silence, my mind really didn't have to be so engaged. I also loved the classes. I had some good teachers and loved the postures and the meditations and everything, but Swamiji's energy was at such of a higher octave, is a word, vibration than mine, that just being in the silence and tuning into that, I felt more uplifted than anywhere else I had ever felt until that time. So it was natural sometimes when he would be around and I would have been doing that service with him, and then I would start to leave, you know, my eyes would be filled with love because of gratitude and just the uplifted space. Once I looked at him with that love, and I could feel me, I was going a little into, you've given me this opportunity to love this way. It's come from you, therefore you, you know, I love you. It was just right in that place of not quite form, but form, and you wouldn't let it go there at all. He just said, I wasn't saying anything, it was just all, you know, in my gratitude and my pronoun. He said, don't stop here. Go all the way to God. Go all the way to God. And I knew that he knew what he was talking about. He was going there, and that's where he wanted all of us to go. He didn't want us to get hung up in, gee, I have a great teacher. Master's a great teacher. Swami's a great teacher. But go all the way. I remember Swamiji was a man of great power. You know, remember when many of us heard Master's voice the first time? Oh, Paramahansa! You know, it was so loud, and it kind of, I mean, I had just seen his nice face and, like, you know, nice meditations and a little bit of chanting, you know, which was, but then suddenly this, you know, kind of made me sit up in my chair really well. Well, Swamiji also had that kind of power. You didn't hear it very often. But he would say it when he talked about spiritual communities. My words are registered in the ether. It's moved by the word of God, and he would get really loud. Well, I heard him one other time in a way that's helped me a lot over my adventures in life. especially about the body. He had several surgeries while I was working Crystal Clarity, and we had like a rotating kind of healing team that would just do what they could, and he would always want to escape from the hospital really soon. Like, he would have this major surgery, and the doctor would say, absolutely, 10 days, you have to stay here, you can't move. And he'd say, oh, sure, sure. So he'd go away, and within about 2 days, he is literally breaking out of there. He's getting all of his friends, he takes his luggage, and he's just like, doctor, I'm going to my house. You know, this is what's happening. And so he did, and he always healed a lot faster. So he had a hospital bed in his room for a while during one of the times, and we would get to kind of watch the medications and give him the medications. And one time, I believe it must have been a hip this time, he was in his regular room. And we had a walker for him, because there he just had hip surgery. And, you know, if he needed to go to the restroom, he needed to be able to have somebody help him get up from bed onto the walker, and then he could pretty much steady himself from there. But he was at that point where he was ready to go, and he said, you know, I need to get out of bed. So I went in, and, you know, you'd sit on the bed, and you learn kind of how to get yourself aligned and how to work with the walker. And he sat there, but he was really pushing it and getting out of the hospital and in trying to move about so much. So he sat there for just a couple of seconds. He didn't really have the energy and the strength yet to get up and start walking on that walker, which he was determined to do. So he sat there, and he said, all of a sudden, kind of out of nowhere, came this voice, I am well! I went, wow, I believe you, and I think you are. Gosh, you know, and he said that about two or three times, and then he had marshaled enough strength, and we got on the walker and went, and he always recovered a lot faster than anybody thought he could, and a lot of that was that willpower and opening up to God's healing grace. Once when he was working on the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, he would sit there, and sometimes if he was in a flow, you know, I would call him, how are you doing, Swamiji? Would you like a dream? And I wouldn't object. I would go over, and he'd be working in his office, which was just down from where his sitting room and living quarters were. And he was at his computer working on his book, and he was going. And I walked in, and I just, you know, quietly sat in the chair thinking, I'll wait for him to finish. And then it was kind of like, you know, he wasn't going to finish. So he said, just work on my head while I'm working here. I said, okay, Swamiji. So I came over, and it was so hot. It was like fire, you know, just all that energy. And it, you know, kind of helped him to have somebody, you know, help dissipate the heat a little bit. He'd say, yes, it gets so hot sometimes. And he was cranking out this amazing high vibratory works through his body. He said during that time something very interesting. He said, he just sort of stopped what he was doing. And he would let many of us read, whoever was around. If he was working on something, for many reasons, he enjoyed having people comment, he enjoyed sharing it, and he enjoyed hearing what it was like and getting feedback. So he'd do something, and then he'd have whoever was in the room that time pass it around and read it. And and one time he was writing, it was such a high level of things that he was writing about the Rubaiyat. He was getting into such rarefied airs of ether is kind of how I would describe it. Just poetry, divine truth, divine love. It was all sort of commingled in this very, you know, celestial kind of feeling. And he turned around from his keyboard after I'd been working on his hot head, and he said, you know, I think sometimes that God is withholding my consciousness so I can do this work. You know, because Swami would talk about he wasn't a person given to so many visions, you know. I was walking out on the bluff and Yogananda appeared and we walked together. And he didn't tell those stories, and I don't know how much of that he had or didn't have, but he would say about himself, I don't have that many wondrous sorts of phenomenological. I'm not sure what that word is. Maybe you know that word.
Phenomena.
Just phenomena. That's it. Just phenomena. Wasn't given to that much phenomena, but it really was a feeling that, you know, that this soul could go, could have gone a lot sooner, a lot farther, a lot faster, a lot higher, but that he was being held, Master held him, so that he could do the work for all the reasons, all the good reasons that he did. Let's see. Oh, it's another funny one. Swamiji was very generous, always. Well, first I'll tell a poke story, because Karen's here and she likes this one a lot.
A what story?
A poke.
Poke?
Yeah, a poke story. You know how we read great teachers throughout time, they want to help us get closer to God. And they see so clearly what our delusions are and what our blocks are. And even as they tune into us more and more, what the very next thing that we could really break through if we just got a little more awake and we just got a little more energy moving forward. So sometimes they take it upon themselves, historically often, to give that devotee a little oomph in one way or another. You know, there's a crack in the pot, the one who hit the devotee saying, wake up, there's a crack in your pot, work on it. Lots of other stories that we've heard like that from other teachers. Swamiji pretty much was very, very gentle. But there were sometimes he could surprise you. I had had a major surgery and I had sort of been unzipped with a scar that was, really long in the 5-hour surgery, and I had a burst appendix and things were there, and I almost didn't come back, and I was sort of sorry I did come back for a little while, because it was nice floating around above the body. But I came back, and I was healing, and Swamiji, I was working at Crystal Clarity at the time, so I was kind of one of his brood, so he was kind of, being in tune, how are you doing, and helped me with healing in many ways, and I was, the scar, it was a major surgery. I had never had such major surgery, and I hadn't had children, so it was all kind of new to me, holding the pillow to cough, because it hurt so bad, where the scar was and everything. So I'd gotten in a habit of kind of protecting the central area where the healing was happening and where the incision had been. And it was just barely healing. I mean, I had the stitches out, and, it was secure, but it was hurting, still. And I was being aware that my aura was still kind of contracted in that space. And I remember going over to give Swami some paper or something from Crystal Clear, and he looked at me, "Hello, how are you today?" And he poked me with his finger right there in my midsection where my incision had been. I was like shocked, gosh, it's so unlike Swami. So, I mean, all kinds of things, what is that? And it hurt, a little bit. And then later I thought, and then he sort of laughed, looked at me like, it's all right. And I kind of thought, yeah, it is all right. I mean, it is all right. It's not really sick anymore. And it only hurt a little bit when you poked me. Look how much I've healed. And, so it just helped me just turn it around, just sort of let go faster of that whole process,
That's a great one.
That's good.
Yeah, it's a good book. And once in India, he said, "Please excuse me, but I don't have much time left, so I'm not going to be so gentle with you anymore, with all of you," he told anybody. "So if I see something wrong, I might just tell you." He hadn't been that way with me. He gave me the name Lahari Tender, for reason, and that's never been one of the easy ones for me. I continue to work on it, but for him to correct me, I took it very deep and very serious, and over a long period of time, and worked on it. So he didn't do it, just willy-nilly. He knew, he was careful, as much as I could take it, which wasn't as much as he could give it, certainly. But he scaled back for my benefit. But now here he is saying, okay, everybody, it's free season. So then the next time I saw him riding in the car, he turned around and he said, you have a tendency to be too bloop. I'm not going to say what it is because I'm still working on it. You have a tendency to be too bloop. And I went, wow, you know that? Gosh, I hadn't seen it, actually, but I knew, and as soon as he said it, it was true. It wasn't always true, but sometimes it was true, and I still hadn't, you know, gotten over it. And there's another one he mentioned. I had been on the battlefield. We all have our battlefields, and sometimes they're just quiet in the meditation room, sometimes they're with gurubais on the job, sometimes it's with a stranger in the street. You know, we all have our karmic battles where the soul gets a chance to rise up and, you know, stand for the light. And I had just been through a knockdown, drag out time of that. It involved other people and decisions and work and dharma and all kinds of things that I consider very important on the spiritual path. And I had been just, you know, walloped in a big way. And I was still trying to get myself, you know, really back up to it. And Swamiji looked at me one day. He said, I would like to see you have more courage. I was like, thank you. Because that became, he was serious. You know, it was one of those ones to work on. So I appreciated it. And sometimes he would say things and I would appreciate it in the moment. Because I always felt Swamiji had such a blessing. I mean, if all the masters of all paths could take this, I think the world would be, you know, self-realized a whole lot sooner. Because he had a way of, underneath there was love for the soul. And then there was the layer where he had to help you get through whatever was in the way. But when he would deliver a correction, it always kind of led first with that feeling of love, and then afterward the love would be there too. It was sort of always surrounding it. It was a love sandwich. It was like, and it wasn't like he was trying to soften us up or butter us up so that we could, you know, take it. It was that he just, it was only because he loved us that he was doing it. It was only because he really wanted our freedom. And he was such a gentle person that you could always feel that, you know. Sri Yukteswar always wanted everybody's freedom too, but his way was, you know, sharper.
He was gentler with you.
He was gentler with me. Others can have other stories. It's true.
Sweet. These are sweet stories. Wow, they're wonderful.
There was a time when there was a person who was really close to him that he'd been, you know, many of us thought, gosh, that person kind of seems like he could have been Swami's son in another life. Or, you know, they just had this special kind of closeness in a way, outward closeness. And Swami, you know, was lovingly working with him, and they were working together, and he was helping Swami on things. And this person had, you know, a path that took them in this direction where they were just about going to leave Ananda, and decided to leave Ananda. And right afterward, I went over, Swamiji, how are you doing? How do you feel? Would you like a treatment? I wouldn't object. You know, I went over, and there he was. But he was, you know, sometimes he would lie flat by the fireplace because it was warm and not a village could be chilly. So he'd be there with, you know, blankets and things, and I would start working on him. And this day I noticed he was weeping, you know, gently weeping. And, you know, my heart just melted as any of ours would to see such a great soul and you know, feeling that way. And I said, oh, Swamiji, is it because so-and-so is leaving? He said, yes. And my mind went to all the reasons why. I mean, Swamiji, you know, had this connection with him on kind of a personal level. He'd nurtured him and counseled him and grown with him and given him responsibility. You know, he just tended him like a mother, father-mother, for many years, and now he was gone. I thought, that must be sad to lose, you know, to not have your friends like that again, or to have them leave you when, you know, you've been their spiritual teacher, it's just not easy to see people go away. And I had lots of reasons I was thinking of it. And he just had one reason. He said, yes, because I'm afraid he won't be able to keep doing his kriya. And that was what he was weeping about. That as long as that person was in the community, they would remember. They would have the support and the environment. And he didn't know. You know, I don't know. He didn't know. But just that feeling of maybe not, just that feeling of not knowing was enough to make him just weep for that. And that dear friend. Also in a similar vein, you know, Swami was always loving, but he was always dharmic in it. There was a person who he'd given a lot of energy to, and this person, you know, had loved him, and he'd loved that person, and it was a wonderful friendship. And the person left and asked Swamiji for something. And I knew Swamiji just had only positive, you know, loving feelings for this person, so I sort of thought, he'll probably, you know, answer that person's request. It wasn't a big thing the person was asking for. He would probably give it to them. And I said, so Swamiji, you know, well, are you going to give that person that thing, whatever it was? He said, no, it would not be dharmic for me to keep giving to that person because they're speaking against me. It would not be dharmic for them. It would not be good karma for them. And so that made me meditate a little bit more. What does that mean? You know, so just always to be generous, always, you know, to give isn't the appropriate response sometimes. You know, in that case, he saw that that person's soul needed him to withdraw his ray. You know, I mean, they'd left him and were speaking badly about him, so that's so, but, you know, children have tantrums. But he just, no, it's not. That person for that person's soul, I need to withdraw. I can't just keep giving them. That was an eye-opener for me.
He didn't want to reward someone for doing something that was really adharmic. So that would be really contrary for him to do that.
Yeah, it wasn't even that it would be rewarding them. It would just be continuing a certain kind of relationship with them, which is, you know, a long-term friend asks you for something, you try and do it, even if you're mad at each other. You still try and help your friend. But in this case, he saw that that wasn't going to be.
So it was very case-specific.
It's just, you know, God's will. That's what's right for the soul.
Sometimes it hurts to do God's will.
Sometimes it's not comfortable for us, yeah, to do God's will. In cases. We can't just act out of our nature, even if it's tending to be a good nature. You just can't follow, you know, even good habits. Yeah. At some point we have to tune into God's will. Swamiji was a good example of that.
Is that something that just Swamiji could do? You know, like if I got mad at somebody and just decided to not help them anymore, it's probably on a much lower level.
Well, it depends on the motivation. You know, he was tuning into the good of that person's soul, not his own convenience or. You know, he was free. He wasn't upset with the person. He wasn't.
He didn't have a lot of cross currents of ego to
So you just want to watch your own heart. You know, if it's really, you know, true guidance comes in the intuitive stillness. So if we're in a place of stillness, it's the better place to ask, well, what do you want me to do, God? And be open to the answer. But Swamiji said, he's interesting, he would say the truth is always kind. He would always err on the side of kindness. You know, and he could have, I'm sure he saw a lot of truths about all of us that he could have, you know, just said, but he would have to think, is it kind? To say that truth. See, I have one few minute thing to do, but otherwise, anybody have any thoughts, stories, things that come to your mind from the vein of tonight?
I had a question. I'm imagining that he didn't spend a lot of time talking about what he was going to do. You know, I'm getting the sense, you know, if you say God is the doer, that it's almost like what's going to happen next, you don't even know. You're just trusting that it's, that, you know, and so
I think more than anybody I've ever known, Swamiji went from what his inner guidance with Master told him, you know, like it's time to write this book or that book or, you know, the music that was given to him. Is that what you mean? He didn't,
yeah,
like, think about planning it and then
he wouldn't, like, choosing. I guess when I'm thinking about doing something, I'm telling everybody what I'm thinking about doing, but I'm imagining that he would just start doing it, you know, when the time...
Not necessarily. You know, for some of the big projects, I think he lived pretty openly with everybody. You know, he was so natural in his humanity and his openness. And if he was thinking, oh boy, I hope I get to work on the Gita, but I don't know if I will because I can't get it. And he shared all of those thoughts with us.
Okay.
You know, maybe I will be able to. You know, I'm hoping to write this. I'm planning to do that. So he did share his thoughts. You know.
But he's not committed to exactly how that's going to happen. That would be the difference, where he might have an idea that Master might want him to do something along the line, but he'll keep checking back with Master as he goes forward with the project and shift in a very different direction from when he might have first talked about it.
It's a little bit like skiing. The problem with talking about something is then we put this energy out, and if God whispers in your ear to do something else, you've already mentally committed to this. So it's a little bit like skiing. When you're skiing, you have an intention. You're trying to go down the hill. But at the same time, you're intensely aware of the present. If you're not paying enough attention to the present and you're just looking down the hill, you're going to hit a hole and you're going to crash. But you have to have some intention of where you're going, right? If you drive your car from here to San Francisco at night, you can't see San Francisco. Your intention is there, but you're paying attention to what's in front of you. So I think Swami would just go through his life like that. He'd have an intention. He'd put out with great energy, I am going to write this book.
Mm-hmm.
So it was there. But at the same time that that's there with all his willpower, you have to stay incredibly open in the present in case Master says, now stop and do something else. Because if you're not listening, you're not going to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, and it's tricky to be that committed but be relaxed and open at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
For me, if I start telling everyone about something, I've built up this big head of steam for it, and now I might miss a clue that I'm not supposed to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But he wouldn't fall into that trap, so it's sort of both, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he used to say, I think he used to do this, he used to recommend at the end of each day, give everything to God. Give everything to God. And I think, you know, he was pretty good at that practice of being free, like David said. If he started something off in a direction, many projects he started but didn't finish because it wasn't the right time. So he put the energy, you know, he used to say, put out energy. You can't just sit there and God's going to give you an engraved invitation, go do this. You know, you have to, you know, use your will and your reason and lean in a direction and put some energy into it, but without determining that that's it till death. You know, just put the energy in and then listen, stop, look, listen, feel, and then. So sometimes he would make an about face. And Asha tells the story of the incorporation had so many people, so much energy, so much time, going in a direction, and then almost at the end, so I'm just stop it. Just whatever had happened in the ether. He tuned into the shift of energy somewhere and said, no, that's not the way we'll do this.
As far as the importance of putting energy out, he taught me a little lesson recently. I mentioned very briefly last week that the first thing he ever said to me was an admonishment. He snapped at me basically for trying to pretend that I was innocent, but really I was trying to blow my own horn about things. And then sort of to bookend that, as we know that many of us have had opportunities just to get in a blessing line when Swami is there encouraging people to come up and We do so and feel quite gratified to have been and privileged to have the opportunity to do that. And I, too, nothing very profound ever happened. I just I felt good doing so. It was good to get really close and get its touch and so forth. And during the SRW of 2012, which was the last time I saw him in the body, I was doing the same thing, and I tend to be pretty restrained because I'm afraid I'll behave in a way that would be not reflect well on me. So better to do nothing than to just be yourself, kind of a thing. And that day, so the same thing was happening. A nice little greeting, and Swami is good and non-committal, but you know, welcoming. And I get up to say goodbye, and, holding hands. And then something happened to me where I said, you know, I didn't even think about it. I just turned into him and I said, Swami, it's just so beautiful to see you. I'm so happy to see you. And I did it. My heart was there. Mm-hmm. And he pulled me down with a hand that we had held together. And he says, I'm so happy to see you as well. I'm really happy to see you.
Oh.
And he was just telling me, there's not a heck of a lot he could have done before, because I'm just sitting there like a statue, basically, really all wrapped up. And as soon as I just opened up a little bit, that said, okay, to him that I'm prepared to receive him, to him he will give the power to know God. And it was kind of an example of that.
That's sweet.
And I was so gratified, especially since it turned out later to be the very last time I saw him in the flesh. And it was so contrasted to the first time.
You know, you just said something about being open. You opened a little bit, and he was able to do that. And
exactly.
You were talking about your opening. And there was something Asha sent around not too long ago. I don't remember if I was in the South or not, and she said that Swami was asked in the 70s, 73, 74, what does it take to stay on the spiritual path? Do you remember getting that? No. And there were three things, but the first one, he said, it takes, and I don't remember the adjective, something like exquisite honesty, absolute honesty, with God, Guru, and one's own conscience, and also the willingness to be wrong. But that, I think, is kind of an answer to be wrong. Mm. You do it, you get to the best you can do, and then you do it, and you're aware of what's... But like he said, he would try things, and then he would go, okay, that's it. Mm-hmm. That's another way. Mm-hmm. Don't do it. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
I've
seen
that willingness to be wrong takes a lot of courage.
I've seen people leave the path because they just weren't able to accept that they were wrong. Not easy for some people. You have to get the high energy people, especially the energy gets going in a big direction, and then you know, just that again, that's humility, isn't it? Just to say, well, God, you know, I give it back to you. You're the doer.
Then the other two parts of that were, the second one was to remember that the spiritual path is a matter of life and death. Mm-hmm. I put that by my computer. That's what I keep right at my desk. And then the other one was, and regular practice.
Okay. Those are good.
Joe Tisch sent one of those out within the last
maybe
few years, and he added, I think he made this number one or number two, a sense of humor, which I just said, it's so helpful. That does help you laugh at yourself. It's just been... So life and death, but also a sense of humor, I think. That's good.
What a pair.
Yeah. To me, that's like a good one. I mean, you try to make sense of things, whether it's right or not. And that second one of the life and death was, you know, if you stay on the path and you get it right, you don't have to die again. It's a matter.
I'm going to close with one story, then we're going to listen to a song of Swami's and then have a poem. Biraj and I had been in Pune, you know, in the ground-baking part of the land work, and sort of hacking away in the forest there in the jungle. And Swamiji came to town with Dharmadas and Nirmala, one of the earlier visits. And, you know, it's always a symbol, whatever you're doing for the guru. You know, we're hacking around the jungle, but we're also hacking around inside at our places that are not what we want them to be. And so in that process of challenges on the land, etc., what came up for me was that I was absolutely sick and tired of being myself. I did not want to be myself anymore. I really wanted to get beyond the ego. And the way I looked at it was, I just don't want to be myself anymore. I want to be free of all that. What did Swamiji call them? Bundles of self-definitions. Yeah, I wanted to be free of those bundles of self-definitions. They were really getting in my way. So I really wanted them. And so Swamiji came, we went out to a dinner, everybody's around, and he's going around, and you know, he looked at me, and I was struggling, kind of could see that probably, and kind of looked at me, and he said, "So, how are you?" I said, "Oh, I'm hanging in there. Is there anything I can do for you?" I said, "Yes, Swamiji, I would like a new name." I'd asked him for a new name many times before, and he always said, "You have a nice name, just leave it." And I said, "You know, I really would like a new name, Swamiji, because I'm finished. I'm just finished with who I am. I'm just finished. I just want to be finished." You know, and I just kept saying finished. So then, next thing I know, I hear these Indian words, these Sanskrit words coming out of Swamiji's mouth. He's sitting at the head of the table here, and I was sitting right here. I hear this, "My Khatam Hai," Swamiji said, and I thought, "Oh my gosh, that sounds like, how am I going to remember that? It doesn't mean anything in the world to me. How are my friends going to remember that?"
What was it?
"Ma Khatam Hai."
Oh.
God, what in the world is that? How will I ever be able to know? And then I said, "Well, what did you say, Swamiji?" And by now, the waiter who had been hovering a little behind Swamiji came into my eye view. And he said, "I was telling the waiter that I was finished." So he didn't give me that name. I was finished. He did give me another name, which was a little bit nicer. My friends could remember it.
That is fantastic.
That's funny.
That's hilarious. I'm finished.
So how long did you have to wait for the hurry?
Actually, that night, this is part of Swamiji's generosity, that night he went home into where he was staying. We were all in the same apartment building. He was upstairs and we were down. He called us about an hour after he got home. He said, "Come on up." So Viraj and I went up. He said, "If you really do want spiritual names, I found two for you." Just went, "Wow," said he. Gave us our names and wrote down what they meant. And very sweet.
Said you found two, he meant for you and Biraj.
Yeah, Biraj hadn't asked, but he got one. It was a sign of prayer on my part, the wife.
Right.
What does Biraj mean?
It means having a presence, knowing one's self.
Oh, and what is your name?
Lahari. As Swamiji said, it means tender.
Oh, that's nice.
Sometimes. Sometimes it's a pain. But... okay, so now...
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, guys, for sharing. Now, this song has been one of Swamiji's favorite ones. So now you're all wondering. I wonder who's going to guess. It's one of his favorite ones, and it came to him after a time of challenge.
Live Without Fear.
Okay, you get it. Mm-hmm. So now we get to close our eyes and listen, or just quietly listen.
In your presence, I live.
Thank you.
The green summer fade and winter draw near. My Lord, in your presence, I live. Without fear, through tempest, through snows, through turbulent tide, the touch of your hand is my strength and my guide. I ask for no riches that death can destroy. I crave only thee, your love and your joy. I ask for no riches that death can destroy. I crave only thee, your love and your joy. The dancers will pass, the singing must end. I welcome the darkness with you for my friend. The green summer and winter draw near. My Lord, in your presence I live without fear. Through tempest, through snows, through turbulent tide, the touch of your hand is my strength and my guide. I ask for no riches that death can destroy. I crave only thee, your love. I ask for no riches that death can destroy. I crave only thee, your love and your joy. The dancers will pass, the singing must end. I welcome the